Grab your Slickers and open a Snickers. It's time for Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com.
.com?
.com.
Delayed reaction. That was brilliant. I was like, is he doing a bit or did he just fall asleep?
Oh, I'm doing a bit. I'm not your dancing monkey all the time.
You know what? The pause plays. The pause definitely plays. This is the weekly cult and exploitation filmcast that is so good, it's apparently worth waiting for. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host, novelist, slash screenwriter, slash Lieutenant Omega Force, slash Fick, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
How's it going?
Very well. I'm very excited about this particular recording.
I feel like we have... I feel like there's going to be a faction of people listening to this that think that we are pulling a joke on them because we are wrapping up Heist Month and we're wrapping it up with a movie that feels like it probably should have been scheduled mid-card on this this WWE heist movie event. But we saved it for the end. We're going out with it.
You know, and we're going out with it for a very good reason. And I think we should just lay it out right now.
Well, first, before we do that, I want to remind
you.
Do you
want to do some business?
I got to do some business. To feel justified in my appearance on this show, I feel like I have to do all the businessy stuff. So here we go. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And of course, if you want to hear our back catalog, we're on iTunes and Blog Talk Radio. And if you really like the show, if you think the show is worth traversing a flood in a jet ski through a high school for some reason, Patreon.com/junkfoodcinema is a great way to financially support the show. And for as little as a dollar an episode, you actually get access to content no one else gets to hear. I like the underscoring.
There
I like it quite a bit. That was fantastic. And scoring, actually, for this movie is going to be an interesting conversation, I think.
I think so.
What movie are we wrapping up Heist Month with, Cargill?
Hard Rain.
Take everything you know about Mother Nature.
So, are we all gonna die?
Yeah, we're all gonna die. Just not yet.
Combine it with everything you know.
What are you still doing here?
You gonna arrest us, Sheriff?
About human nature.
Come on, give us a kiss.
Get out of here!
Mix in $3 million in cold, hard cash.
Stinks. Putting your ass on the line for somebody else's money?
Where the hell's the road?
It's there. Somewhere.
And water.
No! No! Everybody all right down there?
And you have the perfect recipe.
Probably just see us better.
So we can't see at all.
For the perfect crime.
Turn down your lights!
Tom! Hey, Tom!
We just want the money! You guys!
Oh, God.
Walk away! The clock is ticking!
Do your head!
I put out on Twitter... I put a thing that just said, hey, guys, see if you can guess the last two movies for Heist Month. And I got something like 38 responses, people guessing multiple movies. So one person guessed Fast Five. Nobody even mentioned Hard Rain.
Well, because Hard Rain is kind of a heist movie. It is a heist movie, but it is a heist movie from a very different perspective and is mostly a chase movie.
Yes.
But it does hit all the hallmarks of a type of heist movie. And I think it's important to talk about because it is not an Ocean's 11 style heist movie.
No,
it is a very different heist movie. It's about a heist gone wrong in a very fucked up situation. And I mean, let's lay it out. There's one major reason you are going to want to revisit this movie if you have not. If you're like, yeah, I saw that 20 years ago, like I was. The movie was written by a guy who was a hot screenwriter at the time. He had written Speed. He'd written a couple of other notable studio movies, all of which you'd recognize the titles of. And we'll get there in a moment. But he wrote this and then would go on to move into TV and would create and write a little show called Justified.
Graham Yost, what was amazing to me revisiting this movie, the first time I watched it before the research was even done and I discovered that, is my first thought is, this is like a Southern fried noir that somebody just drowned.
Yeah.
That's what this movie, somebody poured hundreds of thousands of gallons of water on top of a Southern fried noir.
There is dialogue in this movie that comes out of Christian Slater's mouth that when you stop and think about it, you totally hear Timothy Oliphant saying it. Because it is so Graham Yost's voice. If you love Justified, first of all, if you're listening to this podcast and you haven't watched Justified, you have six perfect seasons of television ahead of you that you are going to fall in love with. It is so fucking good. It is one of the best things on television and of the last decade. It does not get the love that it deserves.
Agreed.
When you talk to people who have seen it, they all speak reverently of it. You don't run into people who are like, yeah, I mean, that show was okay. It's like, fucking Justified, man. Has a perfect beginning, has a perfect end, and it is six great seasons of television. And the thing is, as a show, it was a masterclass in dialogue. Like, if you want to be a writer, watch that show and be fucking jealous of things that spill out of people's mouths, plot twists that happen. It is such a masterclass in how to do that. And this is early proto Justified. This is a bunch of bumbling crooks that aren't goofily bumbling. They're just not really crooks, are pulling a heist because of the way something happens. They are robbing an armored car during a flood, as a flood happens, and the sheriff and his deputies are going around town trying to get people out. And all of this swarms around this guy who's just been a part. He's been on a ride along in an armored truck for a couple months, and he gets caught up in this fucked up thing. And everything gets fucked up. And almost everyone in this movie, there are only two characters in this movie that are not awful at some point. They are all fucking awful assholes. All of them. Even Minnie fucking Driver is fucking awful in this movie. The fact that, we'll get to this, but every character in this movie is awful and selfish and stupid in some way, shape, or form. But it leads to a film... you're never going to see a movie like this again. Like, the sheer scale and scope of what they do in this movie, where you just sit there going, wait, how did they make a movie with a flooded town without it just being CG? Because they didn't have the CG then. The fuck did they, this is practical.
Yep.
Holy shit. The fuck did they make this movie? Nobody would make this movie in this day and age. And dear God, does every moment of this movie work?
It really does. And I think it's amazing that originally they wanted to call the movie The Flood. And this is one of the things that really interests me about film in general, and especially in the movies that we talk about, is how zeitgeist can affect a production. And so they wanted to name this movie The Flood. And then right about the time they were getting into production, there was a resurgence of disaster movies, things like Dante's Peak. And I think Volcano came out the same year, wasn't it?
It did. And then the next year after we had the Volcano movies, we had the Asteroid movies.
We had the Asteroid movies with Deep Impact and Armageddon. But yeah, there were just all of these.
And
all these,
Twister,
that was the other like one.
Really,
that was
Twister's
one.
What really kicked off the whole movement.
Yeah, it was like somebody resurrected the corpse of Irwin Allen and just started bringing disaster movies back. And so they decided to change the name of the movie to Hard Rain because... this movie really isn't about the disaster. It's about the heist and the chase. It's a disheister movie. Is that a thing we can coin? I think I'm going to go ahead and coin it.
I mean, let's be honest here. There's a reason we're talking about this movie. Somebody got way too fucking giddy about a movie that came out a few weeks ago. He got really, really excited about a movie called Hurricane Heist.
Which, you know what? I still haven't seen, and I'm very upset with myself that I haven't seen it. But it's
already out of theaters.
No kidding.
It came and went.
What, you mean Hurricane Heist didn't have the staying power of James Cameron's Titanic, and it's not going to stay in theaters for 37 weeks? Crazy.
It didn't have the staying power of Tyler Madea's Boo 2, like whatever that fucking thing is called.
Tyler Perry's Madea's Halloween 2. Oh, God. Oh God, you just reminded me that those movies exist.
They exist. Like, oh, no, boy. It's like this thing just came and went, but you were so excited. I remember having barbecue with you and your ex-roommate, and you guys lost your fucking minds over that. And that's what triggered Heist Month.
Yes.
Because we're like, let's do a Heist Month. And we're like, and that's like, well, if you're gonna be excited about Hurricane Heist, we gotta talk about the original. We gotta talk about Hard Rain.
Hard Rain is, I mean, Hurricane Heist looked like if you took Hard Rain and set it during Day After Tomorrow. That's kind of the elevator pitch I'm sure they got that movie sold on. And it reminded me how much I really did fucking enjoy Hard Rain. And I feel like Hard Rain is a movie that doesn't get a lot of, like, people don't talk about Hard Rain.
No, they don't, because it was, you know, it was it's in the waning days of Christian Slater. Christian Slater was a huge star for several years, could get anything made, and then his stars started to fade. And he just wasn't, like, everybody was kind of, like, done with him. And this was at the tail end of that. And it was also at a time when Morgan Freeman everyone knew who Morgan Freeman was, but he wasn't epic yet. He wasn't considered that big epic actor. And it's got Randy Quaid, and no one's ever sure what to do with Randy Quaid. And it had Minnie Driver, who was a big indie film star, but not a mainstream star. And it was just a weird kind of movie. And yeah, it was a movie that was not the type of film that was big at the time. But that is exactly the type of film that movie lovers who revisit it will fucking love the shit out of, because, man, is this movie fun.
You know, it's funny you say that nobody knew what to do with Randy Quaid then. We especially don't know what the fuck to do with Randy Quaid now, but for entirely different reasons.
Well, yeah.
For 20 years, I've been eating shit. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Well, tonight I'm changing the menu. From now on, everything I eat is going to be shit-free.
This movie starts off with a really amazing... And again, I'm sure a lot of this is accomplished digitally, but there's a really amazing pan down from the Paramount logo. The clouds start gathering over it, and then they just pan across this landscape of flooded town. And it just keeps going, and you go over highways, and you go through fields where houses are half submerged, and you just kind of keep reaching and keep reaching until we drive right up the main street of this little town, which incidentally is filmed in Huntingtonburg, Indiana. So I never knew that about this movie. I never paid attention, but it's filmed in a little town in Indiana that was also apparently where they filmed A League of Their Own. So even though it is this tiny little town in Indiana that nobody knows about, it's been the subject of both A League of Their Own. It's where they filmed both A League of Their Own and Hard Rain. And I incidentally grew up in Indiana, so I was like, oh, this is kind of awesome. And we go right up the main street, right into the heart of a town that is literally, like, most people have evacuated because it's about to be underwater. The dam's about to break. And we're introduced to Randy Quaid's sheriff character, and immediately, in a sequence that I like to call Chekhov's disgraced sheriff, we're told by a couple of different people that he has been voted out. He is no longer going to be the sheriff at the end of his term, and he's still just there. And what I like so much about the way this movie is structured is that for a good portion of this movie, you really do believe that Randy Quaid is just a good-hearted local sheriff.
Yeah, that he's like, and he's doing what he needs to be doing, and he's a good guy.
And I think part of that is because it doesn't dawn on him to not be that guy until he's in the thick of it.
Yeah.
It's not a situation where he was always a villain. He's not a wolf in sheep's clothing. There comes a point where he just decides that because this town has fucked him over, it gets to a breaking point, and he decides. And that's what's great about the structure of this movie, is that you have Ed Asner. By the way, Ed Asner, America's Bob Hoskins, driving around with Christian Slater in this armored car, and they're just kind of gabbing at each other. And then they hit the flooded road, and they're stalled out. And wouldn't you know it, here comes Morgan Freeman and his crew to help them out. But uh-oh. They actually just want to rob this armored car.
And everything goes wrong
because, as Cargill mentioned, they're not real thieves.
This is pure Graham Yost. And this is what I was talking about with Justified. This is not a, hey, this guy wrote Justified, you should watch this other thing he did. This is everything that works about Justified working here in an early proto version. Because the big thing that this movie does is it shows how greed takes ordinary people and turns them into stupid criminals. And nobody in this movie is a superhero. Nobody in this movie does anything super heroic. This is very much fucked up things going very wrong and doing what they would do in this situation and being pitted against each other. And alliances flip throughout this movie. And I love it when a story does that, and a story does that well. And this movie does it so well. Like, there are just so many great character beats in this of watching the characters be broken down and being seduced by $3 million. And when you think about this in terms of what we've just talked about all month, we had a movie in which the heist is, you know, $11 million a piece. We have another heist that is $11 million a piece. We have another heist that's about stealing like $500 million in a night in just pure losses.
Yeah.
And this movie is about what these people would do for $3 million and for their piece of $3 million. And when you think about the fact that everyone in this movie is poor, everyone in this movie like has a day job, and a day job, like as Christian Slater says, pays a, you know, three figure salary, which for the '90s is, yeah, that's exactly what that was. You know, that was not, you know, he's not making good money. So $3 million is a lot of fucking scratch. And what would you do for $3 million? What would you do if you were a small town sheriff who's was losing his job at the, you know, at the end of the month or whatever, and you've got a shot at, you know, your share of $3 million. What do?
Yeah.
You know, there is a lot of really good questioning things in this movie, but it all results in very bad things happening to people who make really shit life choices.
Yeah. And I think that's what I really enjoy about this movie and why it had that sort of Southern fried noir flavor to it is that nobody involved in the heist, nobody who gets robbed, nobody in this movie, in this story, is not from this tiny town. It is a very compartmentalized heist movie where you don't have people going to Vegas or going to LA or following the money, you know, going where it is. It is something that kind of a plot, that a scheme that came up organically just from living in this town.
Well, I don't think the original thieves don't live in this town. They don't know anybody. They don't know Karen. They don't know the cops. So Morgan Freeman is outside. Morgan Freeman doesn't know them.
Oh, that's interesting. I could have sworn that he was from this town.
No. They're from nearby, but they're not from the town.
So, yeah.
But they are from,
they can't be from too far away because, like, they know what armored cars are coming through this town.
Well, yeah.
They can't be from far away.
No, they're not.
And then, of course, this leads to Ed Asner, who gets pretty high billing in the opening credits, despite the fact that he's in the movie for about 3.5 minutes.
He catches a bullet in the neck.
Catches a really like tragic and severe death for Ed Asner in this movie. Which,
it's surprising that Ed Asner gets billing over Betty White in this movie.
It is. It is kind of surprising. But that leaves Christian Slater to kind of defend the money and kind of he's incensed by the killing of his partner, who we later find out is his uncle. And decides to steal the money and hide it so that the thieves can't get to it. And this leads into a playground of, wouldn't it be cool if we had this location, but it was full of water? It feels like that's a lot of what the production design of this movie is, which is, can you imagine this scene from an action movie, except it's in this building and it's full of water? And I'm going to tell you something, Cargill, that is probably not going to surprise you for a moment. Do you know who was originally supposed to direct this movie?
No.
John Woo.
Well, that makes sense because, first of all, Christian Slater is a producer on this. He's a co-producer. And he had just done a movie written by this same screenwriter called Broken Arrow.
Yeah.
And had gotten along famously with Woo. So that doesn't surprise me. But this is at the point where Woo had given up on Hollywood and was just like, fuck you guys.
Well, this is right around Face Off, though, or I guess the year after Face Off. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I find it really interesting when you think about the action sequences and when there's literally like pieces of boats hurtling at people and like,
he hadn't left yet. He'd still had Windtalkers to do, but he was getting sick to death of Hollywood.
That's a really interesting sentence. No, he had to stick around because he still had to do Wind Talkers, which when you see Wind Talkers does kind of sound like a prison sentence. Like, no, he had to do it. It was part of the condition of his parole that he had to make Wind Talkers. But no, just like the scene in the church where the boats are coming through the stained glass window.
Yeah.
Like, you slow that down just a little bit. That's a John Woo sequence right there. So,
there's even the, there's actually a John Woo moment in here where Christian Slater goes both guns akimbo. He ends up with two guns firing in two different directions because that's what fucking John Woo movies have.
Through the course of this, Morgan Freeman's crew is chasing Christian Slater. Christian Slater stumbles into a church that is, you know, starting to fill up with water, and he gets hit on the head by Minnie Driver, who is... Is she the groundskeeper there? Is she a preacher?
She's an artist.
She's just doing the stained glass windows.
She's renovating this church for the sake of the beauty of it.
It
is her art project. She is the local college artist.
Apparently she's from that school where she ends up with Matt Damon.
Matt Damon.
Yeah. No, 1998, I feel, was a pretty big year for Minnie Driver.
It was. You could not escape Minnie Driver.
Minnie Driver couldn't escape this movie. She talked about how much she hated doing, which I can, by the way, I totally get. Like, sometimes you hear actors bitching about being on a movie and you're like, come on. But it's like, this movie is essentially not acting. You're just swimming.
Yeah. I mean, you're doing all your scenes, but you constantly have to be wet. And unless it is a heated fucking set, it is going to be cold as fuck when you get out constantly. You're going to be cold and wet and your entire body's going to be pruney. And fuck that.
Yeah, I can't even imagine what it must have been like to... And in the size of this tank, I cannot imagine in my wildest dreams that it was heated. So that had to be some cold fucking water.
And Minnie Driver is a phenomenal actress who's not given a lot to do in this movie. She becomes the, she becomes the damsel in distress at some points. She's really kind of an awful person for the first half of it.
She kind of is, yeah. By the way, John Woo left this movie to make Face Off because even though this movie was released in January of 1998, it was originally supposed to come out summer of 97. So John Woo did actually leave this movie to do Face Off. And this movie hilariously played as a trailer in front of Payback. And Payback is another production that had famously... another movie that had a famously troubled production, so it's just interesting that those two movies got paired up like that. Minnie Driver isn't really much of a character for much of the movie. It's really more about everyone chasing Christian Slater, and Christian Slater having this impeachable morality.
Yeah, that's the thing. Is in fact, it's so weird. She saves his life that she has put in danger.
Yeah, exactly.
and she doesn't apologize for having put him in danger, and acts the entire movie like he fucking owes her for saving his life, even though the whole reason he was going to drown was because she clubbed him over the head with a crucifix.
Yeah.
Because he walked into her church during a disaster.
Yeah. 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 Let's stop and think about that for a second.
Yeah. No, that's the thing is Minnie Driver's awful. She's supposed to be relatable and she's not. She's like, she at least does some right things at the end. So you feel good about Christian Slater risking his life to fucking save hers. But no, she's awful. And that's the thing is everybody else is awful, but everybody else is awful because they're greedy.
Yeah.
The only other person, there are two people in this movie who are not awful. Christian Slater and Henry. Henry is the henpecked husband of Betty White, who is, it's the only time in movie history you will hate Betty White.
Yeah, even in like Lake Placid where she's cussing at cops, you're still like, that's adorable.
Yeah. No, here you are supposed to hate her. She's nailing it. She has a great final moment with her husband in the movie, but because the movie then goes, hey, you know what? We spent some time with these characters. Maybe we should go back to them for a minute.
Yeah.
You're supposed to kind of hate her. But that's the thing is this movie is just full of detestable characters.
It really is. Like, you imagine what this town must have been like when it wasn't underwater. Like, I'm not sure I'd ever want to live here because there's a lot of assholes in this town. Oh, my God. Even people on the sheriff's payroll even before they decide to go bad are just like creepy as fuck. And you
there's only one character turn I'm not 100% in on. Like, it makes sense in terms of everything else that's going on. But it's still, I feel like it's just a little tweak. And that's Deputy McRapey.
Yeah.
Now, he spent the entire movie talking about getting into her pants, like putting that on someone else, like, and clearly projecting. Like, you know, there's something smart going on here. It's like this guy only thinks of this girl as a piece of ass. Like, he could, this, his fellow deputy could not possibly be in love with this girl. That's not possible. He just wants to fuck her. Why? Because this guy just really wants to fuck her.
Yeah.
But the way he goes about it is just so gross.
Super gross.
And it justifies him getting murdered really badly.
Yeah.
But it's still one of those, yeah, that's the type of story thing that we don't do anymore.
Like, that's true.
That's just, yeah, we just don't, we don't like that in our blockbusters anymore.
No,
but, yeah, so that's the one moment where I'm like, taking her to kill her because she's a witness and making it look like an accident makes total fucking sense at that point. Him, hey, I think I'm going to rape you before you drown is a little...
come on, Hard Rain. You're better than that.
But it really doesn't... It doesn't do anything really gross. He's just gross. And then he dies and earns his death. And then gets used as a prop in a couple of moments. Because this movie really does... You're like, how much business can you have to do in a fucking flood? And oh boy.
There's apparently a lot. They really explore that space quite well. And especially when so much of the danger of a flood is not having enough space, you know, and being drowned and like and claustrophobic, they really do explore the entire town in different ways. Like one of my favorite deaths in the movie is the guy, the hunting buddy they've brought in on the heist, who, as he gets kicked off the boat by Randy Quaid, is swimming toward, the Gaslight pub, and then he climbs up on a ladder, and then a tank of propane from Black Cat Propane, like a lot of on the nose shit, but it crashes into the ladder he's holding onto and explodes because it's being driven by the rushing water. And it's so many things like that where it's like, wow, they found a lot of interesting set pieces in one giant set piece.
Yeah. You've got a house floating away scene. You've got a car floating away scene. You've got jet skis in a high school.
Yeah.
You know, there's lots of hiding underwater. There's lots of escapes. There's lots of fleeing the rising flood there. And it never duplicates the same thing over and over again and does it really fucking well. And it's a great twisty, turny, Graham Yost, deep fried crime, everything goes wrong movie, heist movie, but it is all of the spectacle of the disaster stuff all fucking plays.
Yeah.
And unlike many of the disaster movies of the time, this one doesn't feel dated because they did it all practically. So, you know, aside from, of course, the, you know, the flooding over
the dam,
the dam, which they used models. Who cares? It fucking looks good.
True story.
But yeah, this, it's you marvel at how it looks because it really does look and feel, even today, projected in H fucking D, looks like they shot it practically, like they really shot it in the middle of a flood. Really, really well done.
And I think part of the reason it's so timeless is that it's set, and this is why Southern Fried Noir will always be great, is that these little towns in Middle America, in the West, are so out of time to begin with. They are so anachronistic that there is a certain timelessness that comes from the understanding we all have that towns like this are always a few years behind. That's probably part of the reason why Hard Rain doesn't, it feels like it could have been made yesterday, is because it's set in a town that is probably already 15 to 20 years behind the rest of the country. And that actually definitely works in the movie's favor. I will say, as much as 1998 was a big year for Minnie Driver, January of 1998 was a big month for jet skis because we had Hard Rain and we had Deep Rising coming out in the same month.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's a big month for jet skis. I'm sure you could get one pretty cheap in January. It's the off season.
Jet ski sales spiked.
Which, by the way, take a fucking drink with Deep Rising.
Yeah, big fucking drink.
Low tide, sailor.
But it is interesting how this story is structured, because we are introduced to the thieves very early on. And I think, in fact, we have a scene in a bar in the town, which I think is so great, where these two guys are talking about what they're going to do if they got more money and like things that they're going to take care of. And then across the bar, you just see Morgan Freeman. You hear him, and he's just like, say, Kenny, can you help me with the crossword?
26 across.
26 across. And he's like, oh, I'm not really good at those. He's like, no, just look at 26 across. And he slides it across, and he's just like,
you've just been waiting this whole episode to do your Morgan Freeman.
That's an unfair accusation. So he slides it across, and it just says, if you mention money again, I will kill you. And it's just like, did I get it right? And you think, because like all of this is set up to you think that these are just ruthless, like, you know, violent killers. And even when Ed Asner goes down, Morgan Freeman is yelling at the young, like, stop shooting. What the fuck are you doing? Stop shooting. And it's clear that these, you know, as we said before, these aren't professional thieves. These are, Morgan Freeman says to them before they get started, like, now this is my retirement, so nobody fuck it up. And of course, the young kid fucks it up. The young kid, who, by the way, looks like proto Adam Driver. It's very strange. I was like, what? Adam Driver was way too young to be this old in 98. But apparently that actor is like one of the kids from Newsies all grown up. So it's not Adam Driver. It's just an incredible simulation. And then, so you've got that storyline going on where they're chasing Christian Slater around. He has to actually dispatch a couple of them. And then we get to the scene where the police, led by Randy Quaid, have got the thieves cornered. And Morgan Freeman holds up Christian Slater and is like, if you want me, you're going to have to shoot through him. And it's in that moment that Randy Quaid makes the decision. It's really important to state that, because in any other movie with any other writer, I feel like it would have been the sheriff was just bad from the get-go. This is a moment of self-discovery with Randy Quaid's character, where he realizes, no, I want that money. I'm kind of fed up with all of this. Because after it happens and after that shootout goes down, he has to convince in that moment all of his deputies to go along.
Yeah.
It's like, this is $750,000 apiece. Does anybody have a problem with that? And they kind of slowly come on board, except for Deputy, I'm going to call him Deputy So-and-so, who's just the young
Deputy,
like,
Lovestruck.
Deputy Lovestruck, who's like, I'm not cool with this. Of course, he feels like he has to go along after that, or he's going to get killed. But it is interesting how it shifts, and suddenly Morgan Freeman he still wants the money. He's still working against Christian Slater, but he's also not.
He's not the bad guy anymore.
And I feel like that's entirely because, and this was actually trivia that our researchers uncovered, that they redid the ending after the test screenings. They did a lot of it's a big reason this movie was kind of pushed back, is that you know, Morgan Freeman was talking about the ending, and he said, you know, I played a bad guy in a movie, and they showed it to an audience. We're letting an audience tell us what to do now, you know. And the audience said, well, I don't want him. I don't want Morgan to die, and I was a thief. He should get some money. So the audience basically didn't want Morgan. The turn in the movie made it so that the audience didn't want Morgan Freeman to A, die, which he was supposed to do, or B, not get any money. Like, they wanted Morgan Freeman to end up escaping, which is entirely why at the end of the movie, when he's rowing away, he has saved Christian Slater's life and helped take down Randy Quaid, who is the bigger villain of the movie. He still stumbles across one of the three bags and takes that with him, because the audience not only didn't want him to die, they wanted him to get away with some money. It's really interesting how much this movie was shaped by test screenings.
Yeah. And in a good way.
Yeah.
Because this is a really satisfying movie. It really does. It really does work. And it really does. You do get to a point where you forgive Morgan Freeman for most of the bullshit that he's done to the movie, because he was never trying to hurt anybody.
Yeah.
And he's constantly, every time he goes back, it's like, whatever you do, don't kill this guy. Don't kill him. He won't tell us where the money is. But he's stressing. He's not trying to kill people. So when the sheriff is like, fuck it, let's kill them, we can't have the witnesses, it's like, oh yes, this is the bigger threat. This is the bigger bad guy.
Yeah.
And he has decided to go this direction. And you understand why he goes that direction. You understand why that money lures him in. That it's just the perfect situation. And it's that great question. What would you do in that moment if this opportunity that you never thought about presented itself? What would you fucking do? Like, all you had to do is kill some strangers who are already some shitty fucking people as is. Except there's this one guy who's just, he seems like an innocent dude. Like, but would I kill him for $750,000? Yeah. And you're talking about people who are probably making $20,000-$25,000 a year. Like, this is literally, as you know, in terms of like 2018 dollars, it's not like $750,000. It's like, I mean, that's a lot of money, but that's not a lot of money.
That's not money you'd kill for.
That's not money you murder for. But at this point in time, with these jobs in this part of the world, $750,000 buys you a nice plot of land that you own, and you can live off that for a long time. And you can start up whatever it is you want to do for a living, and you don't have to do shit for anyone else anymore. That is, what would you kill for that? And yeah. These guys go, yeah. And one of them goes, no. And they're like, one of two things is going to happen. You're going to shoot me, or I'm going to shoot you.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it works. And that's, and that, be, this movie, this story becomes the fundamental basis that Graham Yost would then base his entire television career on.
Yeah. And there's even a moment early in the movie where they're breaking into a boat dealership, and all of the young guys on Morgan Freeman's crew are like, let's take this, let's take that. And Morgan's like, no, we just need this one. And they're like, well, I mean, we broke in. Can't we just take whatever we want? And it's like, even in that moment where his crew has already killed someone, they're trying to rob, you know, $3 million from an armored car, and they've broken into this boat dealership, he still only wants to take the one boat that they need and not go crazy with stealing the boat. There's all these little, like, hints along the way that Morgan Freeman's character is doing a bad thing but isn't necessarily a bad person, which is really, I think, very interesting.
Want the money. You guys walk away. We won't kill you.
Let's talk about, we hinted at it before, but let's talk about the music in Hard Rain.
Oh, is there music in this movie?
There might be. And it's funny, when I watched this the other day, because I've revisited it now two or three times in preparation for this episode. And the first time I watched it, I remember thinking, whoever's doing the music for this is a big Alan Silvestri fan, because so much of the score sounded like Alan Silvestri. And then come to find out, it's not Alan Silvestri. Cargill, who did the music for this movie?
Chris Young.
Now, how do we know that name?
Well, Chris Young has done a lot of great stuff. He's done some brilliant movies.
He really has. It's just funny because of your connection.
Yes, yes. See, I was going to get to the point that, hey, yeah, I made a movie with him. He scored Sinister. But more than that, he scored several of the films we've talked about over the years. Great fucking films. Notably, the Hellraiser sound films.
For both 1 and 2.
And created those Hellraiser themes and did work on various Spider-Man movies and has been constantly scoring films for a while. He is one of the greats. And he's one of the greats that not everybody talks about, because he tends to be the great guy that you get for smaller movies, because honestly, the guy's made his money. And he just wants to score stuff that he loves, and he wants to play around with stuff that he loves. And you can feel it in this movie, because man, I'm so glad we're talking about this, because you mentioned Silvestri, but there's another, he's playing around with something that is clearly his own love. He is doing a deep fried, heist goes wrong movie. I'm sure the way people were looking at it, particularly in the 90s, was something like a Western in the water. He goes full Morricone at points in this.
There's a lot of harmonica.
There's a Morricone harmonica. It's not just harmonica. It's Morricone harmonica. It is very much Once Upon a Time in the West, which, by the way, take a drink, because the fact that we haven't talked about Once Upon a Time in the West is pretty fucking criminal.
Yeah, it is. And in fact, I remember the first time I saw that movie a few years ago, I had to watch it like two or three times in a row. I couldn't believe how good that movie really was.
But so, yeah, he does some very interesting things. The music in this movie is fucking phenomenal. It is probably one of Chris Young's best scores. I think hands down. It's just, it sounds so great. It's so powerful. It really drives this film. And then at the moment, sells that deep fried, ness of the movie with the harmonica, and does it so well where it doesn't feel like he's aping Morricone, but you feel that influence, and it's like, that's so fucking cool.
And then, of course, I feel like we have to talk about the very John Woo-esque way that Randy Quaid's character is.
Randy Quaid.
Randy Quaid.
Just Can you mix a few drinks at the sidebar?
On it.
All right, so in the 90s, we actually, Randy Quaid was kind of a meme in the movie scene. And me and my friends in particular had a whole big meme about it, you know, where we would just, you know, we'd be watching a movie or see a movie and we'd be like, you know what this movie needs? And invariably somebody would lean over and go, what? Randy Quaid. And the,
not a point of view you hear too much in these days.
These days, no, but no, well, no. I mean, Randy Quaid went full crazy. Like, he's one of those people that was huge in the 90s that is now batshit today.
Yeah. Just like Scott Stapp from Creed. It's crazy how a lot of guys from the 90s have gone
legitimately nuts. Yeah. Legitimately nuts. But yeah,
and for a time, Minnie Driver, as it turns out, went kind of crazy as well. So,
but Randy Quaid was Ooh. A fun Randy Quaid. And that's exactly how you'd say it. Like, that was just for a long time. That was a gag. And like, I did that gag last night and my wife's like, wow, I haven't heard you say that in years. Like, it's been a while since I've gone Randy Quaid.
Do you know what my favorite part of National Lampoon's Vacation is?
Randy Quaid. We may have just added another meme to the pile here.
I feel like we can't do that one on a t-shirt, though, because you have to say it a very specific
Stargrove.
Stargrove. Stargrove. Yeah, you know who else kind of makes an appearance in this movie, but not really, is Bruce Springsteen. Because how many times do they reference that fucking song in this movie, The River? It gets, not only does it get referenced by name, but there's even a moment where they reference the Johnstown Company. Like, Jim says he used to work for them, which is a reference to the river, which, again, gets quoted later on. And Johnstown, Pennsylvania is most famous for an 1889 flood caused by a dam failure.
And how does this movie end? What song comes up? Is it the river?
Oh, my God.
No.
We need to have a discussion.
Yes, we do, because this is probably probably one of the worst needle drops. Like, in my mind, it is the worst needle drop in a great movie that I've visited since Gran Torino, where you get to that point where you're like, man, that movie's good. And then Flood by Jars of Clay comes on.
I need to make a confession. Bless me, Cargill, for I have sinned. When I was in middle school, early high school, I went to youth groups. I went on retreats.
Yeah, me too.
But the reason I did it was because there was a girl at my church that I thought was really cute, and it was just a way for me to spend time with her, and I didn't...
Jesus doesn't like it when you do that.
No. I even went to a fucking, like, Newsboys concert, and yeah, dude, it was...
Give me that Christian side hug. That Christian side hug. Give me that Christian side hug. That Christian side
so
hug.
So much of...
I'm a rough rider, full of Christ's love. Give me that Christian side hug. That Christian side hug.
There's our t-shirt.
Have you ever seen...
Oh, no, you've made me watch that. Untold.
For those of you listening that don't know, you need to Google Christian side hug right the fuck now. You need to pause this, and you need some of Christ's love in your life right now, and it's so full of Christ love.
It's full of something. So the long and the short of my story is that when I watched this movie, that song came on. Not only did I recognize it, I was able to sing along because
you owned the cassette single that had it both on both sides.
Not only did I own that song, I owned a book that was written by the group DC Talk.
Oof.
Yeah, and it was a book about people who had been martyred all over the world while on, like, missionary journeys and shit. It was... It's like, it's weird that that's the embarrassing part. Like, me now, when I am beer swilling,
rock
cursing...
Out, it's Amy Grant, it's a Michael W.
Dude,
Smith.
Like, look at, like, now I'm like, I
right now, every Christian of a certain age is, like, having flashbacks of their childhood and the terribleness of Christian rock.
Where, like, minor notes were forbidden. Like, you couldn't have a minor note in your song. Yeah, no, dude. So when this song starts up, I was like, no, they're not going to really. And then it was, and if I can't live after 40 days. I was like, oh, my God, kill me. Kill me now.
The crashing waves lift me up
so high that I cannot fall. Like, it was like this nom flashback hearing that song, like going to youth group and like wasting my entire youth not doing fun things because I wanted to be a good Christian is my fucking nom.
But here's why I hate this Neil drop so much. So much. It was a pop song, and it's probably one of the highest grossing Christian pop songs of the modern era. You could not get away from it. Really catchy. But for a movie
infectious, I would
about
say.
A flood with a centerpiece action sequence in a church, I feel like that's on the nose. That's on the nose. Like there's an extra nose on the nose.
That's so that on that's on Carl Malden's nose.
Like it's like what we call in the business, it's cake on cake. It's putting a hat on a hat. Like it is.
Wait, stop. I've heard putting a hat on a hat. What is cake on cake?
Cake on cake is you're trying to add something really good onto something really good and you're ruining it. Like it is literally, that's cake on cake. It's like, yeah, you're taking this, you're trying to add another cool moment onto a cool moment and you're actually just muddling the moments. Like it is, that's what it is.
I only want now, because you said that, a 12-part podcast series where the band Cake reviews different cakes and it's called Cake on Cake. And it's just like the guys singing a song about why they really love this red
velvet. Except the knowing what I know about that band, they would then discuss pies because... because they do what they want to fucking do. Like they don't like they are a band that, you know, every time a promoter brings them out, they're like, so we'd like you to do, we're not going to do our hit songs. We might play one or two in the encores, but we're going to do our new album. But the audience is here to hear. You're literally at a, you know, you're at a festival show. Why are you? No. We're going to play our new album. Your new album isn't out yet. We know.
Wow.
And we're going to get the audience to sing along.
Thanks for that insight, Cargill. That slice of cake you just gave us. I really appreciate that.
That is correct. But yeah, they would be like, fuck you. We're going to do pie. And then one episode, right when you're in like, oh, okay, we're this is cake on pie. This is great. And then they're going to be like, no, we're going to do cake this time. they'll just fucking, by the way, I fucking love cake. They're amazing. So cake talking about cake or pie, I'd be down with.
And I love cake or pie. I mean, let's be real. It's both amazing.
Yes. But yeah, so that is, but cake on cake is, that's what it is.
That's interesting.
And I feel like that's just, God, it's so fucking on the nose.
It really, it's so really fucking is. On
the nose. And it's so like somebody's like, this is perfect. It's a perfect way to end the movie. That 20 years later, we're like, no, this really was not the perfect
Well, you end it on a freeze frame on a not great joke. And then that song plays and it's like, you want to try that? It's like Tyrese. We talk about Fast Five. You want to do a second take? You want to try something else, or are we just good with that? We're good with that. Moving on, I guess. But yeah, no, I enjoy so much about this movie. I think one of the things that I really do like about it is that Christian Slater has a tendency, I think, to come off in a way that puts him at arm's length with audiences. Like, there's just something about him that I think a lot of people fail to connect with. And I think by virtue of the fact that so many people in this town are such asshats, he comes off in this movie possibly at his most likable since like True Romance, which is, it's crazy. Like he is so fucking likable in this movie.
Yeah, no, he really is. Well, and it really is. It's, I honestly feel it's grandiose writing. Like it's not only the way the character's structured, but those, the clever Yost dialogue. Like my favorite line in this movie is, you know, he's in jail. They think he's a looter. He's telling the story about what really happened. And he's like, and so and the sheriff realizes he hid the money. He goes, you hid the money. He goes, yeah. And one of the deputies is like, why'd you hide the money? And he goes, because I don't like carrying around that much money on me.
Yeah.
Like it's such a great, clever Yost line that you can actually hear that line coming out of Timothy Oliphant's mouth. Like yeah. You just hear it because it's that, that's funny. Like there's, it's, it just, it nails. And this movie is full of that. And Christian Slater gets a lot of these really good lines that makes him a clever, funny, likable person.
Well, and there's, again, there's an element of discovery in these characters where they're allowed to skirt action movie cliche a little bit. Like one of my favorite moments in this movie is him and Minnie Driver are trying to get to they notice that as they're swimming along, the water's about to reach the level of a transformer, like on an electrical pole. And like, shit, we got to get out of the water. And they climb up a metal like rig, and they get out of the water. And for a second, they're like, whew. And then Christian Slater looks and he goes, oh shit, this is made of metal. And I remember it was hilarious because I was screaming at the screen, like, what are you doing? Get off of that. It's metal. And there's a moment where he realizes, like, oh no, this was a bad idea. Never mind. Let's go over there.
Which is a perfect setup for another death.
It is. But what's great is, like, in any other movie, they would have just made the right decision the first time.
Yeah.
If he is a cliche action movie hero, he makes all of the right choices the first time out because he is always in control of the situation. This is a guy who's just trying to deal with it the same as everybody else.
Yeah. And it's what Yost excels at. Like, he makes his characters very human, and it is their good nature and it is their intentions that make it what it is. There's a small little headcanon for me in this movie.
Ooh, I'm listening.
So there's this great moment where Morgan Freeman is there with Christian Slater, and he Christian Slater acknowledges that, yeah, he's thought about it. Like, he, up until this point, he's lied and said, no, I haven't thought about it. I haven't thought about robbing the truck. I've never. And then he goes, Belize. And Morgan Freeman's like, what? He goes, Belize. It's a country. It's like, I know where Belize.
I had the same fucking thought.
Yeah, it's near Zihuatanejo.
Yes, exactly. When he fucking rose away, I was like, oh, we're going to find him on a beach in San Juantanejo.
Zihuatanejo.
I had the same fucking thought. That's hilarious. Yeah. No, it's one thing about this movie. It didn't do well in the U.S. at the box office, but it found a lot of its popularity and a lot of its money on home video release. It got very popular when it hit home video.
It's good.
It is very good.
There's nothing wrong with this movie. There's nothing really that you can go, yeah, this movie is stupid. The movie's really smart the whole way through. It works. There's nothing wrong with it.
It's like the Berenstain Bear effect, where people just think of this title and they remember it being bad. But there's nothing to really apologize for. I mean, you know, like, we've talked about a couple of things that don't work as well and some of the, like, troubling dated things. But as far as structure, as far as story, characters, the effects, like, there's nothing to apologize for.
No, it's just a good fucking movie.
And yet people remember it as being bad, I guess just because it didn't make money. I don't know, but this is a very good heist movie, and one that I am actually... It's like when I opened the show, I was like, I feel like a lot of people are going to give us grief that we're ending with Hard Rain, but those people, I guarantee you, have not watched it recently, if at all, because Hard Rain is a great Southern fried noir that somebody dumped millions of gallons of water on top of.
Written by one of the greatest working writers in Hollywood today.
Like, oh, man.
And who at the time wrote a number of, like, seriously, the guy wrote Broken Arrow and wrote, I mean, he's credited with Speed, but we have since learned that so much of Speed came from Joss Whedon, which, why is Speed so awesome? Why does Speed hold up? Why is Speed great? Well, because you have something written by Graham Yost that was punched up by Joss Whedon. Like, yeah, okay. Yeah, those are two guys who are going to go down in the annals of history as legendary writers. But yeah, he's just such a great, solid writer that writes great villains. Like, that's the greatest thing about Graham Yost and what works here. These villains make sense. The villains in Justified make sense. There's never any real mustache twirling character. Like, the villain in Speed makes fucking sense. Villains in Broken Arrow make fucking sense. These characters, like, that's what Graham Yost excels at, is his heroes occasionally are interesting. A lot of times his heroes are just very heroic, because what he cares about are villains and why we do bad things as human beings and why that drives interesting stories. And that's what this is. This is everything he does well as a writer in its early gestation period, in his early writing days.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, because even though the sheriff is the bigger villain of the movie, he has a line in the film where he says, you know, for 20 years, I've been eating shit, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So now I'm changing the menu. From here on, everything I eat is going to be shit-free. Like, you understand the motivations of every single... There is no bad for bad sake, good for good sake.
Dude, I gave my life to this town, and this town shit on me. And all I've got to do is take this money. And these people want to take it from me. It's not even their fucking money. All I got to do is make sure they don't make it, because guess what? They're probably not going to make it anyway. Fuck them. And then it just, once you're in, you're committed. And at that point, you've done the bad thing and you have to kill them. Like, that's the thing that works with this movie, like how overboard they go. They go because at that point, they're fully committed.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like, oh, hey, look, we really kind of fucked up here and got off on the wrong foot. Let's just call it a night. Like, there's no chance for that.
Let's throw out, before we wrap this up, let's just throw out one more heist movie kind of in the junk food cinema vein that we would recommend people track down and watch. I'll throw out this one just because I just saw it recently. I thought it was a lot of fun. Trespass. Have you seen Trespass?
Oh, yeah.
Walter Hill movie. It's always great for me to see a Walter Hill movie that I've never seen before, but it's Bill Paxton and William Sadler, so already awesome. Those two guys go into East St. Louis into this factory because they hear that they're firefighters from Arkansas who are fighting a fire where a guy has a map of this factory, and apparently there's some gold buried there. And when they get there, it happens to be in the middle of the ghetto, and it's a ghetto run by Ice-T. And who's in Ice-T's crew? Ice Cube. It's the only movie that has both Ice-T and Ice Cube.
They make a perfect drink.
They really do. And so it's kind of a siege movie where you have the two guys inside who are refusing to come out, and they don't want to just escape because they want the gold, but everybody outside is trying to kill. It's actually a lot of fun. It's highly flawed, but it's a lot of fun. So I would recommend that one as well.
Well, if you have not watched Logan Lucky yet.
Oh, fuck yeah. We almost did that one, but then we realized it would be a shit ton of Soderbergh for one month.
Well, we realized it would be a Soderbergh month, and then we'd have to do a fourth Soderbergh, or else it would just feel weird.
Yeah.
So, but
which I guess we could have done Out of Sight and just made it an entire Soderbergh month.
I thought about that, because Out of Sight's a movie I really want to do.
Take a drink. We're covering Out of Sight at some point.
Out of Sight. Yeah, but I really want to do Out of Sight back to back with Jackie Brown because.
Oh, yeah, because of the Michael Keaton connection.
Yeah, because it's, well, they're, and let's tie this all into this. Justified by Graham Yost is an adaptation of an Elmore Leonard story set in the same universe as this. In fact, one of the things that me and several people have commented on in the past is Justified's one great failure. Is that they never found a way to bring Ray Nicolette into the show and have him show up at some point and connect that to Jackie Brown and Out of Sight, because Michael Keaton plays the same character in both those movies,
yep,
who is a federal agent.
I am a DEA agent. Sorry, that's a different movie.
you know, another great heist movie. Point Break.
For sure, man. Take a drink. Serious, I feel like there are very few heist movies that don't really fit our creative. That's kind of a genre that we really do.
We love. And yeah, and if you want to hear, if you guys want to fucking
deep dive.
Top Cappy.
Ooh, I don't even know what this is. So
Top Cappy is one of the original great heist movies. It's a little slow for this day and age. You've got to be a film lover and be willing to endure what a late 50s, early 60s style crime film is. I think it's the 60s. It's a little slower. The editing is, it's definitely a film that Soderbergh was borrowing from. For the Ocean's movies, but it is a great heist film.
Yeah.
And I think it's Topkapi is nice. How it's pronounced. And it's really good. It is definitely for heist fans. That's one to go with. And of course, then The Sting.
For sure.
The Sting is absolutely, absolutely a thing. And then Jackie Brown.
Oh, by the way, there's another connection in Out of Sight to the Tarantino verse.
Yeah.
When George Clooney, when they're going through mugshots and they find George Clooney's mugshot in Out of Sight, it's not the mugshot from Out of Sight. It's the mugshot of Seth Gecko from Dusk Till Dawn. So there's a lot of interesting Tarantino-verse connections in Out of Sight. And I will throw out just one more. Kansas City Confidential from the 50s. If you want to see where Tarantino got, a lot of people talk about City on Fire as a huge influence on him for Reservoir Dogs, but Kansas City Confidential is the other giant piece of that puzzle.
Oh shit, you know what? Let's continue on this and Taking a Pelham 1-2-3.
Yes, Taking a Pelham 1-2-3.
Again, another big influence on Reservoir Dogs, but a great fucking movie.
Speaking of great villains.
I mean, that's one of the sad things is it's one of the Tony Scott films that you and I do not love.
Yeah.
I love the first two-thirds of that, but I do not like the third act, which a film written by Brian Helgeland and directed by Tony Scott that I don't love. It just kills me that that is a thing that exists.
It's a rare miss.
But the original one, with Walter Matthau. Oh my God, guys, you need to see
Walter Matthau going up against Robert Shaw.
Yes. Like if you've never seen that movie and that sentence didn't get you hard, why are you listening to this podcast? It is Walter Matthau versus Robert Shaw in a train heist movie. Like, fuck yes. So,
oh, I am visibly turgid. Don't you worry. And that brings us to the junk food pairing. And I think this week...
I've got it this week.
You've got it this week.
I got it this week.
Take it away, Mr. Cargo.
I'm going to say a French dip.
Ooh.
A French dip. First of all, French dip is a great sandwich. For many of you that are familiar, you know, it's pretty much just a roast beef sandwich. But the whole thing with a French dip is it comes, by the way, with au jus. Now, if you ever see it on a menu, it will say French dip with au jus. Au jus is French for with sauce, or with juice.
So it's with juice.
It's with juice, which is something I've always, it's like when you see on a menu that has Tex-Mex on it, it says it comes with con queso. It's with cheese. But the whole point of a French dip is you take this wonderful sandwich and you dip it into this au jus which is this like beef broth that it then soaks up, and it is soaked and you eat this delicious soaked thing. And this movie is just fucking pure soaked junk food. And I think that you want to watch this movie with a French dip and every bite is just soggy. And that is exactly the way it's supposed to fucking be.
I like that. I like that very much. I also like that you went with that French dip and not the one you have to pay an extra $20 for the classy escort that you paid for.
That's a French tickler.
Oh, that's right. Sorry about that. That's another thing that comes up when you talk about rain on my face. Guys, thank you so much for joining us for Heist Month. Really excited that we got to talk about all of these great movies. And as we mentioned, there's a lot more. We could do two more heist months.
We could do a heist year. We love heist movies, and these we got to talk about some of our favorites, ones that we've been talking about we were going to do for years. And I hope you enjoyed it.
Fantastic. Cargo, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Find me on Twitter and on Instagram at Massawyrm, MASSAWYRM. And my new book is coming out. You can pre-order it. It's We Are Where the Nightmares Go, available wherever you buy books.
And that's not about the creation of the Arby's sandwich franchise?
No, it is a collection of 10 horror stories, some very serious and terrifying, some funny. It is just very, it is the Cargill you have come to know and love through this podcast, writing just a bunch of short stories. I wanted to write collect together some short stories I've written and have an excuse to write some new ones. And I'm very proud of the book. It comes out June 12th.
Nice. You can find my new book, This Is Where Brian's Nightmares Come From, which is about the creation of the Arby's franchise, on bookshelves never. But you can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury, and you can find this podcast on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. And by the way, I don't know if I mentioned it on the top of this episode, but we are going to be appearing at Denver Comic Con June 15th through the 17th. We'll be doing a live episode. I'll be moderating some panels. Cargo will probably be signing some books, hopefully including the new one about Arby's. So that'll be a lot of fun. It's not about Arby's. I've been told by sources that I trust that it is not about Arby's. We'll also be at Convergence. I believe it's the 5th through the 7th, or maybe the 7th through the 9th. It's the weekend after July 4th. We'll be at Convergence in Minneapolis, also doing a live show.
And I am going to be at Cinepocalypse from June 21st through 27th.
Nice.
So
that's in Chicago, Illinois.
Yep, at the Music Box Theater. Very excited. I am the co-president of the jury along with Scott Derrickson.
You'll just be executing people en masse.
No, we will. I mean, like, this is actually the cool thing about this. This is the first time me and Scott have ever done an event together. So we get to actually hang out for a week not making movies. Like, we've never really, you know, had the chance to like just do an event like this together. So we're gonna have a great time, watch a bunch of movies together, and hang the fuck out and meet you cool people.
Very cool. Well, guys, that's going to do it for this week's episode. And as I mentioned, that's going to bring Heist Month to an end. But before we go, I just want to remind you that from here on, everything we talk about is going to be shit free. until we start talking about the Italian post-apocalyptic stuff again, because that's that shit we actually still like to put on the menu.